From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. The LA Times reports a Chinese family paid $6.5 million to a college admissions consultant who's admitted bribing multiple schools on behalf of his clients. Here in Southern California, a number of William Singer's clients are reportedly anxious about possible criminal charges against them. The latest on the scandal right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific start to your day. Coming up, two-time Olympic champion runner Caster Semenya lost her effort to continue competing against women without suppressing her naturally higher level of testosterone. The Court of Arbitration for Sport had to weigh fairness to the intersex Semenya against fairness to competitors who don't have her hormonal advantage. We'll look at the effects of the court's decision later this hour. First, the New York Times reporting local high-end defense attorneys have been contacted by numerous L.A. area parents who'd hired college admissions consultant William Singer. 33 parents were already charged back in March. A number of those have already pled guilty. But at the time the charges were announced, federal investigators said they were still looking at others who were clients of the Newport Beach-based Singer. He pled guilty to bribing college coaches and administrators and was cooperating with the feds. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times reporting from its sources that a family in China paid $6.5 million for their daughter to attend Stanford University as a member of the sailing team. Joel Rubin, Los Angeles Times reporter who was on the team that broke that story yesterday, joins us. Joel, good morning.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me.
First of all, in the case of this Chinese family, I understand this is a source, so you probably are limited what you want to disclose, but can you give us some just general idea of how this came to your attention?
Very limited. It's a number that was the 6.5 million number was one that caught everybody's eye when the feds unveiled their investigation into this case back in March. The U.S. attorney in Boston, who is handling the case, said that that one unnamed family had paid as much as up to $6.5 million. And I think that caught everybody's eye because it was so much above what the amounts were that other families were accused of paying. And so I think since then, everybody following the case and looking into the case has been curious as to who that family was, and we've been asking questions of sources and finally cracked through to somebody who offered up a name, and from there we went to other sources and kept digging and put some pieces together, and then we had a story.
All right. And have you been able to speak with the family at all?
Our colleagues in Beijing yesterday spent the day trying to track them down, went to their house, and talked to some staff at the house, but did not succeed in tracking them down. So we're still working on it.
And what do you know of the status of the daughter who was accepted into Stanford?
So I think my colleague from the Wall Street Journal, who I think you have on the phone, might have something else to say. I don't think we have yet confirmed this on the record, but other outlets are confirming that, and the local student paper at Stanford has said that she is no longer at Stanford. Whether she was expelled or left voluntarily, I'm not sure of that.
All right. Joel Rubin in the LA Times with us. And Joel, just mentioning Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Melissa Korn. Melissa, good to have you with us again. Have you been able to confirm that the daughter was dismissed from Stanford?
Well, we do know that Stanford rescinded the admission of one individual back in, I believe it was late March. They said at the time that they had done so because the person had falsified some information on their application. They didn't specify at the time if it was a male or female student. They still aren't confirming any name, citing student privacy. But the information does line up with what we know about this Chinese student. in terms of that she was not actually affiliated with the sailing team, although it looks like John Vandemore, the former sailing coach, did help in some way, even though prosecutors say not in a material way, he was somehow involved in this. She was not a member of the sailing team in any way.
And Vandemore has pled guilty to racketeering, admitted that he worked with Singer on giving favorable admission status to students who were claiming to have been experienced sailors being taken for the Stanford team. I was surprised that sailing is enough of a high-profile sport at Stanford that students would get favorable admission for sailing. Were you surprised by that at all, Melissa?
Not really. I know that a lot of colleges and universities have slots set aside for athletes for a bunch of sports. So even sports that are a little bit more off the beaten path or more niche sports, perhaps, you have plenty of spots for rowers, for sailors, for fencers. You name it, you know, they're not basketball and football, but these are often not scholarship spots. These are spots that the family is still paying, but that they are getting, you know, some sort of an edge. We saw a lot of this in the Harvard affirmative action trial last fall, where they disclosed a bunch of data about the likelihood of getting in if you are a recruited athlete, if you are tagged as a kind of a special athletic prospect.
We're talking with Melissa Korn of the Wall Street Journal, Joel Rubin of the LA Times. I'd like to hear from you if you are in one of these communities where college consultants are employed, whether you have a sense of their people at the school that your kids are at, that there may be other shoes to drop in the federal investigation of William Singer's college admissions consultancy. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Joel Rubin, the LA Times, have you been able to get a sense of, similar to the New York Times story that came out, that there are a number of clients of Singer's locally who've not been named, who've not been charged, who are very concerned that they could be next?
Sure. Yeah, I think the New York Times did a nice job of sort of summarizing what's sort of widely been known for weeks now, and which we've reported and others have reported, which is that, you know, you can't throw a rock in this town without hitting a high-end criminal defense attorney who hasn't been retained by some family that is nervous that they could be next, either because, you know, it runs the gamut from families that simply hired Singer for legit above board services, right? We should remember that Singer had a very vibrant college admissions, coaching, counseling service that by all accounts didn't do anything illegal. He had dozens and dozens of kids each year who were using him to help with test prep and essay writing and other services and got into college, and now their parents are understandably on edge that perhaps they're going to get swept up in this. And then you move down the spectrum towards people who know that perhaps they crossed a line with Singer and are nervous that the feds are looking at them, and are more than nervous because we know that the feds have been issuing subpoenas to local high schools and issuing subpoenas to families' businesses, looking for paper trails that will connect the dots. Some families have been notified by prosecutors that they are in fact targets, which is a you know, somewhat formal designation that federal prosecutors use to alert people that they are in fact in their crosshairs, and it's often a precursor to being charged. And we know that even some students of or some kids of parents have received these target letters as well. So there is more coming. It's just a matter of when and who.
Joel Rubin, Los Angeles Times reporter, who covers federal courts and agencies. Melissa Korn covers higher ed for The Wall Street Journal. Both of them have been part of teams that have broken significant stories about the college admissions scandal, in which bribery was alleged. And there have been now a number of guilty pleas to bribing college coaches and administrators for preferential admissions to elite schools. Again, if you are someone who is a part of these elite prep school communities, and you have anything to share just about sort of how this has been received in your school's community, or concerns that you've heard expressed, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Melissa, your team broke the story on these target letters from the feds. And I wonder if the concern is among the parents here, maybe they weren't recorded in the as number of the parents supposedly were in the initial charging. But maybe as people have flipped and started cooperating with the government, coaches, administrators, and others, that maybe that could sweep up the second round of parents. Is that the thought here?
It's absolutely possible that some of the people involved who are now cooperating witnesses, formally or otherwise, are helping point prosecutors to other families, other coaches, other people involved in this. That's kind of the whole goal of getting cooperating witnesses. And, you know, they got Singer initially through cooperating witnesses. So the federal authorities, according to our reporting, are asking, you know, how these people connected to Singer, who introduced them, what the understanding was, who else they talked to, who they passed his name off to. There's some indication that at least a few of them heard about Singer from each other. The defendants. So we know that they were chatting. We imagine that they were chatting with other folks as well. So yeah, the putting pressure on defendants, and especially on those who haven't yet or who have not pleaded guilty, to cut a deal, to talk a little bit more, to let the feds know who else is involved. Absolutely, it's kind of part of the way that these investigations work.
Joel, the story that you did in which you report the Chinese family paid $6.5 million for their daughter to get accepted to Stanford, you say that the family actually met Singer, the admissions consultant, through a Morgan Stanley financial advisor. Can you share a little bit more about how connected Singer might have been to these other consultants, financial consultants, and how that gave him a higher profile?
Sure. Yeah. One of the pieces of the story from early on has been that Singer was invited in to a lot of these high-end investment firms, Morgan Stanley being one of them, Oppenheimer being another, and others around Southern California and elsewhere, where he would get a toehold even either through maybe a client who worked at one of these places, or it would go the other way. He would be invited in and give a presentation. And then advisors, wealth advisors who had, you know, their stable of clients would then offer up his services as a perk to these clients. Not to say that the investment firms were paying his fees, but they would introduce him to clients who perhaps had high school age kids looking for help getting into college. And in the case of the family we wrote about yesterday, it was part of our reporting. We learned that he had been introduced to this family through a wealth advisor in a local branch of Morgan Stanley, and we were able to confirm that. And then when we approached Morgan Stanley yesterday, they initially said we have no comment. And then later in the day, after we wrote our story, they came back and issued a statement to us and to others saying that there was a wealth advisor who has been fired. They named him. His name's Michael Wu. They said that he was the one. Well, all they would say on the record was that he was fired for not cooperating with an internal Morgan Stanley investigation into the college admissions case. They would not definitively connect him to to this family, but then other reporting people who didn't want to be named said that he was the advisor working with the family. Not to say he was the only one, but this is the one that the company is putting out there.
Joel Rubin, LA Times reporter, Melissa Korn from the Wall Street Journal. Melissa, just quickly before we wrap, the Chinese family that the story you broke that paid $1.2 million to get admission to Yale, part of their defense has been they just didn't know. And I'm wondering, for Chinese families where reporting out of China is, that bribery is fairly common as a way of doing business there, whether that is a potentially viable defense in these cases, that, you know, for the Chinese families, they didn't know that this wasn't how things were done.
You know, it depends on the family, I think, in terms of how familiar they were with the U.S. college admissions process. That is what their attorney has told us, has said in statements, that, you know, this was a family that was taken advantage of, that they didn't understand that there is a little bit more free choice in where you go to school. Again, it depends on the family, and the prosecutors are the ones making the decision there about how much they believe that explanation.
All right. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Melissa Korn, higher education reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Joel Rubin, Los Angeles Times reporter, covers federal courts and federal agencies, both of them part of teams that have broken significant stories on the college admissions bribery scandal. We'll continue to closely follow the story right here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. The sports world's highest court ruled yesterday that Olympic gold medalist Caster Semenya and other women runners like her who have naturally high testosterone levels must take medication to reduce their levels of the male sex hormone if they want to compete in certain women's events. The ruling by the Court of Arbitration for Sport was 2-1, and it's expected that that will have a significant effect on what the rules are for the next Olympic Games. Now, Semenya has been a gold medalist in the 800-meter run, and the issue here is essentially fairness to the group of women's runners, who some of whom believe it's unfair that Semenya would run with a naturally higher testosterone level and that advantage, versus fairness to Semenya, who, as an intersex athlete, her level of testosterone is naturally higher. This is no supplementation, which provides the advantage. Joining us is Madeline Pape, who's a former Olympian from Australia, who's raced against Semenya back in 2009, just wrote an op-ed for The Guardian about the decision from the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Ms. Pape, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So, you've got the academic as well as the competitor hats you can wear here. What do you think about the court's decision? Do you think they got it right?
Well, look, I was really disappointed with the decision. I mean, there were many scientific questions that were being considered, which are very complicated. And I think it's important for us to recognize that actually the question of whether testosterone and naturally occurring testosterone actually affects athletic ability, or the extent to which it actually affects athletic ability, is something that scientists are debating. So that has not necessarily been determined either way, and that's why this is a very complicated scientific question as to whether or not Semenya indeed enjoys an advantage over her competitors as a result of her testosterone levels.
So if it's not an advantage, if then she takes medication to block the production of testosterone, would that not necessarily hurt her performance?
Again, there are various nuances to this issue. So what I understand, this is not my own area of expertise, I'm a sociologist, but what I understand is that what occurs in your body naturally is different to what we then do to it artificially. So if you were to ask someone to alter their body's natural composition, it could have quite detrimental effects on their health as well as their athletic ability. And certainly testosterone has many functions in the body beyond those that we think about in relation to reproduction, for instance, and it's a pretty critical hormone. So it can have quite detrimental health effects to require someone to suppress their testosterone levels.
Back when you competed against Semenya, did you feel that the competition was fair?
I didn't, actually, and that's, I guess, what has made my journey a little bit peculiar or interesting at this time. So when I was an athlete and when I competed against Semenya at the World Championships in 2009, I was very quick to join the chorus of voices around me accusing her of having an unfair advantage. And I think that was in part influenced by the fact that I'd had a very disappointing championship myself, but also there weren't any other opinions being voiced in that space. So it really was the only Semenya had an unfair advantage. It's really only years later when I began to pursue my PhD in sociology that I encountered the fact that there are many critics and critiques of these kinds of efforts in sport, and began to reflect on my opinion in 2009.
Love to hear from listeners if you are a woman athlete who's competed at a high level, either in college or as an amateur athlete, professional athlete, your thoughts about this and how you weigh the competing notions of fairness to women athletes as a group who don't have naturally higher levels of testosterone versus an intersex athlete like Caster Semenya competing with a naturally higher testosterone level. That's from birth. That is how her body functions. But now, according to the Court of Arbitration for Sport ruling, if she's going to compete as a woman, she has to block testosterone production in her body so that there is not any potential advantage from those naturally higher testosterone levels. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Madeline Pape, former Olympian from Australia, raced against Semenya in 2009. She's a doctoral candidate in sociology at the University of Wisconsin and just wrote this op-ed about her shift in position on whether it's an unfair advantage for Semenya to be able to compete with her higher natural testosterone level. Ms. Pape, I wonder about if you have more intersex women athletes with higher testosterone levels, and on average they outcompete other women athletes in competition, does that potentially have a negative effect on the field of women athletes, those who go into it, or are we just simply not talking about enough potential intersex high-level athletes for this to be an issue?
Right. I mean, a lot of these kinds of questions just involve speculation at the moment, because there isn't a large number of women with high testosterone that we know of, at least in sport. Or at least, we can't say for sure how many women do have high testosterone. And what's been interesting for me is to have seen the number of women's sports organisations come out in support of Caster Semenya. So organisations like the Women's Sports Foundation here in the United States, Billie Jean King is a very vocal supporter of Caster Semenya. So there are many women and many advocates of women's sport who feel that women's sport benefits from having Caster Semenya competing, and that it's in the interests of women athletes to celebrate the performances of exceptional women like Caster.
All right. I want to thank you very much, Madeline Bape, for being with us and sharing your views. Now, what comes next with the Olympics? Are they obligated to accept this decision from the appellate court or arbitration court?
I believe that the decision that the Court of Arbitration for Sport has taken would apply at the Olympic Games, but there are I think, some avenues of appeal that could be pursued. And there is also even things like some of the sort of medical associations for that kind of practices who are asking questions about whether or not.
I'm sorry, we're losing the connection with our guest, Madeleine Pape, former Australian Olympian, raced against Semenya a decade ago and just wrote an op-ed for The Guardian in which she details her shift from a position of, as a competitor, feeling that the competition was unfair, that Semenya is an intersex woman athlete and higher natural testosterone had a built-in advantage, which made the competition unfair, shifting now to the view that that Semenya should not be required to take testosterone-blocking medication to compete. Also with us, Washington Post reporter Rick Mace, who's been following this closely. Rick, thank you for being with us. Have you had a chance to talk with other elite women athletes to get a sense how this is being received?
We've been monitoring reaction, you know, since the decision came down Wednesday morning. And, you know, I think it's safe to say that a lot of the people more outspoken right now are those that are voicing support for Semenya, those who, you know, sympathize with her position. As has always been the case, some of the athletes that feel like she shouldn't be there, they're a little bit quieter. They realize that it's an uncomfortable position. They realize that it's hard for others to really see that side of the coin. And so they're not quite as vocal. But certainly there's been some Paula Radcliffe, a British long distance runner, a big time marathoner. She's been kind of outspoken from the beginning, saying, hey, this may not be the most fair thing for Semenya, but it's the most fair thing for all the other women that have to line up at the starting line against her.
Well, and that's the challenge, of course, for the Court of Arbitration for Sport is the fairness to her versus the fairness to other women competitors. We just have word that Track and Field's governing body says today it plans to enforce its new rules on testosterone levels in women runners more widely than sport's highest court is recommending. So this is a further setback to gold medalist Caster Semenya. The Court of Arbitration for Sport, as we've talked about, ruled yesterday that the IAAF can force intersex women like Semenya with an unusually high testosterone to take medication that would block the production of testosterone. But the court recommended the IAAF not enforce the rules in the 1500 meters and in the mile, saying not enough evidence there that higher testosterone gives women a competitive advantage. But IAAF President Sebastian Coe, when asked whether he would heed the court's advice, said no. In a follow-up statement, the IAAF said it has enough evidence to apply the rules at the longer distances. So that decision closes off a way that Semenya could have continued to compete with her higher testosterone levels, but now in the longer distance, with the IAAF saying they're going to apply this at the longer distances, that makes it more difficult. Rick Mace, can you add more to this report we're just seeing?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the curious wrinkles about this rule from the beginning is that it didn't apply to every track and field athlete in every event. It, in fact, was only targeted at three specific distances, the 400, the 800, and the 1500 meters, so the middle distances, as we call them. And, you know, not coincidentally, I suspect, those are the specialty distances that Semenya runs. So a lot of people felt that she was unfairly targeted here and that, you know, they weren't interested in protecting the sport as a whole, but they really wanted to make sure Semenya didn't have any avenues to compete. So yesterday in the decision, the court kind of upheld the way it implied to the 400 and the 800, but they thought there needed more research done on the 1500. Clearly, the IAAF sees differently, and they think that it should apply to all the distances. I would say that the main one we're looking at here is the 800. That's where Semenya's, just for the past decade, has been one of the most dominant athletes. She's posted the fourth fastest time we've ever seen. She's always a threat to break the world record there. So as long as they say she can't compete in the 800, I think that's the one that really resonates with people, because she's just a special sprinter when it comes to that distance.
Do we have other elite level intersex athletes for whom this is an issue, or or is she an outlier in terms of being at this highest level?
Well, I think she's an outlier. I mean, when you look at the statistics, you know, this is not a common condition, and she's clearly become the face of the issue. And I mean, we should say that, you know, she's not openly divulged her condition. I think by challenging, you know, this IAAF rule, you know, she did kind of step forward a little bit, and it certainly helped cast the spotlight on her a little bit brighter. But I don't think anyone thinks this is something that, you know, is impacting a majority or even a small minority of athletes. It is the rarest of rare cases, and I think that's part of what makes it so complex and so tricky that, you know, do you protect the fairness of this one individual or for the 99.9% of the other individuals that compete against?
Yeah. Charles in Corona says, I'm disappointed in the ruling. I thought the point of sports was to rely on your natural ability. Now they want to use drugs to prevent that from happening. And Daniel in North Hollywood says, I think the decision is wrong. If there's a basketball player who has a big height advantage, that's a natural advantage. She's not using drugs. It's natural. She should be able to compete. Life isn't fair. And the fact that this is natural, Rick Mays, I think is, you know, what makes this hard for so many people is that this, like other advantages which athletes can naturally have, does this go against what we think of as the ethos of sports?
Sure. And that's kind of the argument you keep hearing from everybody. I mean, we watch sports to see people perform at their best. You know, in the most natural way possible. And you keep hearing names like, you know, Michael Phelps. He was a genetic freak in his own right. He had, you know, he's double jointed and he had an incredible wingspan and a lung capacity.
Yeah.
Body produced lactic acid at a different rate. So, and he, across the board, basketball players are unnaturally tall. Baseball players have incredible hand-eye coordination. Football players with their fast twitch muscles. Caster Semenya's you know, genetic benefit happens to be this higher level of testosterone. It's nothing she did. You know, she's not taking any substance to help her. In fact, she's passed every drug test she's ever taken. So I think that's what's so difficult for people to wrap their head around is that, you know, in the sports world, we say, you know, you can't take drugs. That's what gives you the advantage. And here we have the IAAF saying, hey, for a fair playing field, we need this one particular athlete to take drugs to impact, you know, what she's capable of.
Yeah. Thank you, Rick, for being with us and talking about this story, which obviously has been a huge challenge for officials in track and field to handle in a way that is fair to all parties. Rick Mace, sports reporter at The Washington Post, will, of course, continue to follow the story with the latest developments. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I was surprised to find out that the overwhelming majority of hours of streaming that takes place on Netflix is for old TV shows. It's not the new stuff that gets all the attention. When you look at the top 10 shows, 8 of the 10 are old TV series. That's where people spend most of their time. We'll talk about what Air Talk listeners find the most appealing in those old shows back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You might be surprised with all the hoopla about peak TV and Netflix and Amazon Prime series that get critical and audience attention, that it's the old stuff like Seinfeld, Friends, The Office, that are the meat and potatoes of streaming services. In fact, of Netflix's top 10 streamed shows, only two of them are actually Netflix original series. So what is it about some of these old series that continues to garner attention, particularly from younger viewers who might think, you know, this is a totally different context, frame of reference, and yet shows like Friends, like Seinfeld, like The Office are attracting many, many younger viewers. Let's go back to Friends, for example, and here as the group gathers at Central Perk, their favorite coffee shop, and the various thought bubbles of the characters are allowed.
So I told Carl nobody, no matter how famous their parents are, nobody is allowed to climb on the dinosaur. But of course, this went right in one ear.
I love how he cares so much about stuff. If I squint, I can pretend he's Alan Alda.
Oh, good. Another dinosaur story. One of those going to become extinct.
If I was a superhero who could fly and be invisible, that would be the best.
What does Rachel see in this guy? I love Rachel. I wish she was my wife.
Who's singing?
Thought Bubbles on Friends at Central Perk. Joining us to talk about how the old shows continue to garner new and younger audiences, Lorraine Ali, critic for the Los Angeles Times. Great to have you with us today.
Nice to be here.
What do you think is behind this? The particularly series you might think of were from a world that doesn't exist, at least in exactly the same way, that it continues to garner new viewers.
It's so interesting because these shows that, like you said, they're pre-peak TV, they oddly fill a kind of modern purpose right now. Because if you think of younger audiences, a lot of them like to go on YouTube and just kind of jump into something and jump out. These old series, they're not like the serials we have today where you have to start at the very beginning. Like if you miss that first Game of Thrones, that first season, forget it, right? I mean, Now, with these shows such as Friends or like Twilight Zone, things like that, they can jump in anywhere. And these are quick, usually half-hour shows, quick bites. And, you know, as great as they were, you have to admit, the humor's a little sophomoric, which is great and fun. So it kind of like naturally aims itself at a younger audience. But I also think, you know, as much as they don't want to be like their parents, those kind of markers are already out there. Like if you say something like, oh, God, that Office place is so Dunder Mifflin, you know that's The Office. And these kids have like grown up with this shorthand. Oh, that relationship is so Ross and Rachel.
So it's familiar.
Yes.
Yeah, it's multi-generation familiar. To me, it kind of reminds me for my generation as a late boomer, when we'd come home from school and series would be in reruns on television. That's, in fact, how Star Trek became a thing, was reruns after school. And there are the old classic sitcoms from Dick Van Dyke and Andy Griffith and all this kind of stuff. This seems to me like sort of millennials' version of that.
I think that's right, right. I mean, for us coming home, I Love Lucy was there. Did I grow up when that was made? No. But can I tell you every single episode in specific lines? Yes. The candy factory, conveyor belt, right.
And that's certainly a very different world than for me as a boomer growing up. That world of Lucy didn't exist anymore.
Right. And I think with, you know, millennials and even younger kids, you know, my son who's 15, completely addicted to Friends and The Simpsons as well, even going far back into The Simpsons. And I think it sort of also kind of addresses a need for something that's familiar because there's so much new stuff, right? There's so much stuff on TV. And even with kids and all this is new, there's a familiarity to that because they know those cultural markers. They know it from their parents. They know it from just being out there.
Well, I'd love to hear from listeners. What is the old series that you go back to time and time again? 866-893-KPECC. And what are the reasons you gravitate toward that older television series? 866-893-5722. Lorraine mentioned the Twilight Zone. I can't tell you how many times I've watched some of those episodes. And my son, who's 17, he's the same way. And in fact, he'll quote lines from and remind me of episodes that I hadn't seen in years that he's seen more recently. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, KPECC.org. Let's go back and hear a brief clip from the 90s sitcom Mad About You. This takes us to New York City, young married couple.
Okay, see, my big mistake is I listen to you.
I love when you listen to me.
Yeah, no, but then you change.
Of
Of course I change. Everybody changes.
No, I don't. I don't change. I only change for you. You know, I'm over here and you're over there, so I'll go over there, and then I get there, and you're somewhere else, and then I'm in the wrong place for no reason.
866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page. Norma in Lakewood says, maybe they see these shows lasted a long time and have a lot of cultural references. And plus you're taking a chance on a new show. For Astrogoth, it's The Night Stalker of 1974. Yeah, there weren't a lot of episodes of that Darren McGavin starring show. Astrogoth says, still scares the pants off me. Yeah, that was a show as a kid. I absolutely loved that. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. One of the things that Lorraine was just saying about how you can drop in at any time, plus there are so many episodes. The two Netflix series that are most watched, Orange is the New Black and Ozark, there are comparatively a handful of episodes. You're going to exhaust those pretty quickly.
Right. I mean, and with all these shows, you know, they were the older shows. They were made on traditional broadcast networks. And, you know, you're talking, I don't know how many episodes per season. You know, I'm kind of throwing this out there, but let's say 19. And now you have these shows, you know, that are these streaming originals where there's, you know, a whopping 9 or something like that. So you have just an abundance of, you know, shows, and it kind of seems like it will never run out. And we were talking earlier, say, about The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
You could do that marathon, and even though you've seen those before, you might see ones that you have never seen before, even though you've done that marathon every Thanksgiving.
No, that's a really good point. They're the hour-long episodes that they did for one season, for example.
Right, right. Yeah. So it just seems like there's an abundance of those, and, you know, when you're binge-watching, what do you not want to happen? You do not want it to end. And these things keep going.
We have Ed in Manhattan Beach said, in addition to the old scripted series, Bob Ross's old show is very popular. That's the one on the love of art and painting. Is he the guy that on public TV did the? And apparently that's become a deal. And Ed said, a million hours spent watching it on Netflix? I can't corroborate that claim.
I think I heard that yesterday. It was a shocking, shocking moment.
That's so funny. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lindsay in Laguna Niguel, I understand you're a millennial, so what old series do you watch?
I grew up watching the Beverly Hillbillies. first in my grandparents' house, and then we got the DVDs, and my two younger sisters and I still quote it very frequently. That's one of our big kind of joke touchstones. And The Twilight Zone is another that we would watch the New Year's Eve marathons, and that still kind of influences a lot of the media I seek out with grounded in reality, but with kind of a fantastic speculative element.
Yeah, and there are just so many quotable lines from The Twilight Zone. It's a cookbook. Lindsay, thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC. Philip in Beverly Hills said the three I tend to go back to, MASH, Happy Days, and Gilligan's Island. I still watch those on YouTube. I used to watch the reruns when I was a high school student. Philip in Beverly Hills, 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. A lot of love for The Twilight Zone on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I guess that's why it continues to be worthy of marathon status on broadcast television. You can share your favorites in vintage television, 866-893-KPECC. Sandra says, I'm part of the huge demographic who binge watches The Twilight Zone. JP says, I have young adult friends whose favorite tube time binge watching old shows. I introduced one to Our Miss Brooks on YouTube. She's hooked. Yeah, that's one that even the radio version of that's a fairly funny series. Belinda says, I wonder if it's for the same reason I love old movies. They feel like time capsules and provoke nostalgia for what now seems like a simpler time. 866-893-KPCC. From Rancho Cucamonga, which was part of the old Jack Benny show, by the way. Raya joining us. Hi, Raya. What are your vintage TV favorites?
We'd love to watch Frasier and Cheers. It reminds us of the very old, beautiful days
the teenager days.
Yeah, so they take you back to your childhood.
Yeah, they do. They do. It's like a time capsule. You would love to watch them now and over again.
Yeah, they take you back to an earlier time. Raya, thanks so much. Well, let's listen to a clip from Cheers. Obviously, you know, one of the most critically acclaimed and Emmy Award-winning series of all time. I'm sorry, Frasier. Kelsey Grammer as Frasier Crane. His brother, Niall Crane, played by David Hyde Pierce, walks into the room.
What's going on?
Faye's mother thinks that we're Jewish. Just play along.
Okay. Why?
Well, it's important to Faye. Faye is important to me. You think you can pull it off?
No problem. Oh, ham.
Niles. Please. We've got to find a time to tell Dad about this, too.
You mean Papa?
Stop it.
The wordplay on Frasier. What's so funny to me about that series and so brilliant? Great wordplay, but also when they set up episodes for physical humor set pieces, they were just beautifully choreographed, Lorraine.
That's right. And, you know, even right now, just hearing Niall's voice just made me laugh.
I know.
Yeah, and he essentially also is shorthand for just being really uptight, OCD, neurotic. You hear that and it's like, oh, yes, I remember him. He was like the old friend that made you laugh, but he wasn't actually your friend. You just saw him on TV.
One of the things I love, and that series is indicative of others, where the star of the show ended up, because of the skills of the ensemble cast, seeding a lot of the stage. I mean, we saw that in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, a prime example, where that ensemble cast really took over that show. They were so terrific. And the same with the ensemble of Frasier that made it such a classic. When you capture lightning in a bottle like that, amazing. 866-893-KPECC. Rachel tweets at AirTalk, The West Wing. It's a comfort to watch intelligent, empathetic people running the government. Kathleen messages us on Facebook, I love watching the older shows because I know I won't hear any F-bombs or watch people having sex. I Love Lucy is still one of my favorites. Lucille writes on the page, the original Outer Limits stands the test of time. While the special effects don't match what's available today, the stories are timeless. The science fiction series still offers great insight in the human condition. Yeah, and Lucille, I'd add to that some terrific acting performances on the original Outer Limits, too. Kara says, I'm an older millennial. Friends was popular when I was in elementary and middle school. I think it ended when I was in high school. I wasn't allowed to watch it because my parents were very strict. I binged the whole thing on Netflix, so ha-ha, Mom and Dad. I really enjoyed the nostalgia, the clothes, and the pop culture references. Kara, writing on the AirTalk page. TV critic for the LA Times, Lorraine Ali, is joining us. Melvin in Glendale, what show do you return to, even though it's been off the air for years?
Star Trek The Next Generation. That's my show, I think. An optimism for the future, you know, an optimism for humanity. And that it ended up being a lesson that I wanted to teach my newborn daughter. So late night feedings were me and her watching Star Trek, even though she was 2 months old.
Well, she'll probably pick it up through osmosis. Melvin, thanks so much. So those Next Generation episodes, I think my wife has probably seen all of those episodes at least 5 times, maybe more. How many times do you think you've seen the episodes?
Well, I think I went through probably 80% of the series when it first came out.
Yeah.
Probably half the series I've seen a second time, and now with my daughter, probably half the series a third time. So that's about three.
Okay. And there are a lot of episodes. Melvin, thanks very much. Lisa in Eagle Rock said, I started rewatching The Office, which I'd watched originally when I was in my 20s. I'm now in my 40s. Reminds me of a simpler time before all the smartphones and the combative political climate. It's comforting. We're hearing this theme a lot, Lorraine.
Yeah, I think the comforting thing, the familiarity, simpler time. But also, you know, someone made a really good point there. When we're talking about younger audiences gravitating towards this, these are shows they can watch that don't have explicit sexual, you know, content. They don't have all the curse words that streaming and cable have now in family comedies, right? So these are safe zones that you can kind of go to and steer your kids towards. So that is also a comforting thought that there's something there they can watch that you also like too.
Well, let's go back to The Office, which is one of these huge hits with younger streaming viewers. This, of course, about the absurdity of office life, Steve Carell, Mindy Kaling, and others.
Dunder Mifflin, this is Aaron. He's not available right now. Uh-huh. Yes. Sure, I'll give him a message when he gets back.
Michael had chicken pot pie for lunch. Actually, let me rephrase that. Michael had an entire chicken pot pie for lunch. And let me be more specific. Michael ate an entire family-sized chicken pot pie for lunch, and then he promptly fell asleep. So we're all trying to be very quiet so as to not wake him up before 5 p.m.
The Office, one of the most popular of streaming series for younger viewers. James writes on the page, The Gary Shandling Show. That was a very funny series. Felix says, I'm a Gen Xer, and I love watching Saved by the Bell, The Wonder Years, Small Wonder, Home Improvement, The Hendersons, and King of Queens. So again, all from that era that Gen Xers would have enjoyed when it was in original series. And Claudia in downtown L.A. says, when I go to sleep, I have to watch old shows because they don't keep me up. You know the storyline. You still get some new jokes on the reviewing. Cheers, Frasier, Golden Girls, they hold up, whereas shows like Family Ties don't quite hold up as well. That's Claudia downtown. Lorraine, thanks so much. It's been really fun. Appreciate
it. It's been fun. Thank you.
Thanks. Your reader in the Los Angeles Times, TV critic Lorraine Ali, joining us on Air Talk. More to come in the second hour. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. Hope things are going well. And tomorrow, as always, it's Film Week on Friday. We'll hear what our critics have to say about the new movies, including Long Shot, starring Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. Also, Ugly Dolls, an adventure animated comedy from Kelly Asbury, the animator. Those are just a couple of the films coming up tomorrow on Film Week at 11 here on 89.3. Later this hour, we're going to look at tracking in public schools. This is the practice of having the students or the highest achievers put into more advanced classes, or if you're talking about gifted and talented students at the very highest level, having a highly specialized academic experience for them in either a separate magnet school or just tracked into the highest level classes. We'll talk about the pros and cons of that, the advantage to the students who were tracked in the higher achievement classes versus the disadvantages for those students who are left in the classes that are at a remedial level. But first, we're going to talk about the shifting demographics of California. That we see that last year, California had the lowest overall growth rate in its history, dropping to just about 0.5% of growth, dropping in a year from a nearly 1% growth rate. This is the slowest growth rate since collection of data started in 1900. Births down by 18,000 compared to the previous year. And we also have seen a greater out-migration of Californians than those who have migrated in from other states. With us is demographer from the University of Southern California, Professor Dowell Myers. Dowell, good to have you with us again.
Well, Larry, thank you for having me in.
How big a shift is this, looking at it historically?
Well, you know, it goes through cycles. So but the big thing is we had the Great Recession, and we recovered from it, we thought. There was a brief recovery, and then it turned down again. So the economy is booming. So why is there not growth? That's the big question.
Yeah. And how much of this is attributable to people can't afford housing here?
That's the 800-pound gorilla, I think. Everybody lives that in their life. We all know that. We know it in our families. I've gotten emails today from people telling me their personal family stories. You know, it's a slow-moving process, and it's constricting us more and more, and it's starting to really bite right now. That 18,000 decline in births is much larger than any other single year. I look back since 1990, couldn't find a year. It went down more than 11,000.
But if families are the ones who are leaving because the cost of housing is too high, and it's highly educated single people who are coming in because salaries are high, they can afford the housing, but they're delaying getting married and having kids, could that not explain the childbirth decline?
Well, that's part of the process, is delay and lower total fertility by more educated people. Fewer immigrants also. That's all part of it. But really, there's a whole generation of millennials, which we all know about, and they've come of age. You know, the peak millennial year, right now they're turning 29 this year. That's the largest cohort among the millennials. And, you know, you hit 29 and you're thinking about, you know, getting married and you're thinking about having a baby and things like that. And people are so hard-pressed finding housing, not just paying for it. They can't even find it. I've watched people struggle to you know, they're like the 10th person in line on a waiting list. It's the shortage is hurting as much as the price, I think. So if you want to start a family, you want a nest to put the family in. So people are looking elsewhere. You know, I know lots of cases, and I see it in the data. The flow out to Texas is pretty strong. Also Arizona.
Southern Nevada.
All through the West, really. And it's we're losing our younger generation. It's not good. The older people are staying put because where would you really move to? You got Prop 13 property taxes protection, and you got nice weather. Where would you really go? So older people are staying, and younger people are losing them. And that's the future workforce. That's the parents that yeah. we're missing the babies from.
Well, and I know some older Californians who've left to go to no income tax states because there's a financial advantage if they're living off the income that they've invested. But that would then leave behind older people who maybe don't have much means where the tax hit is as significant for them. And we're going to have care concerns, right? I mean, they're going to be skilled nursing facilities, in-home care, all of these things that aging baby boomers are going to need.
That's a growth industry right now. There's lots of jobs available in the health care sector for that support staff.
But do they get paid enough to afford housing that you're going to get people taking those jobs here?
Well, if they double up and triple up, it'll work. But that's not the lifestyle that most middle-class people want to live after a certain age. That, you know, they want their own separate place. And then they can do that more easily in Las Vegas.
Joining us also, in addition to Dal Myers from SC, is Randall Kuhn, who's UCLA demographer and associate professor of community health sciences. Good to have you with us. Randall, your thoughts about what the effect of this is in paying for and providing services to an aging California.
Right. Thanks for having me, Larry. It's a real challenge. I mean, one of the things that we're working on right now are forecasts of the growing aged homeless population in California. So our forecast suggests that the homeless over 65 population in LA County is likely to increase by 2 to 3 times over the next 10 or 15 years. And, you know, homelessness is just one extreme manifestation of a larger housing crisis, as well as a rising aging population, and again, a group. So far, the groups that have reached age 65 have been the early group of baby boomers who did pretty well economically. But there's a group. This next group has borne a long burden of economic disadvantage that's reflected in homelessness, in occupation, in health, and that homelessness, that problem persists as this group ages into over 65, and a lot of them are newly homeless, right? Some of them are long-term homeless, but there's also a lot of people who are homeless for the first time in their 50s and 60s.
We're talking with UCLA demographer and professor Randall Kuhn, Dal Myers, USC demographer and professor. He also directs SC's Population Dynamics Research Group. We're at 866-893-KPCC, a chance for you to ask questions of two experts looking at the slowing of the growth rate in California to the slowest growth rate on record for the 20th or the beginning of the 20th century. century. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, with your questions about the future of California. One thing that we have seen, Dowell, is that more families have turned inland because they've been able to find more affordable housing. So Bakersfield and other Central Valley communities have boomed. San Bernardino and Riverside, the Coachella Valley, have seen increases in families moving there for housing. So are they poised to take economic advantage of that and to create jobs there?
The Inland Empire definitely is striving forward. I just completed a rent study, though, that looked at the top 50 metros in the nation. And the San Bernardino-Riverside metropolitan area is like right behind L.A. with the same affordability problems in the sense that their incomes are rising but not that fast and their rents are skyrocketing, even out there. So it's an improvement if you can hold your job from L.A. with your income from L.A., but if you convert to a Riverside or San Bernardino income and you face the local price, you're in the same boat. Almost all of California is facing this right now.
Well, at least you'd have the advantage of potentially finding a place to live, because one of the problems you were saying with coastal L.A. is there aren't even units to find. At least there are homes on the market in inland California.
Yeah, there's more construction there. So, yeah, you can always get your toe in the door. But then you're paying top prices for new construction. But you can do that.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. David writes on the page, good, we're finally starting to stabilize our population rather than thinking we can have infinite population growth in a world of finite resources. When you're stuck in traffic, you think, hey, I wish there were more people here. Millennials having less kids, that's a positive trend. It's a responsible and rational approach to an overpopulated planet. But Dowell, you know, one of the problems is we've used younger people to pay for the services for older people.
Oh, you need to maintain a balance. You can't get too out of whack. And this is unprecedented in history of the nation and even the world. We're so top heavy with the older population now that basically the ratio is about twice as high of older people to working age. And so every working age person has to lift more weight, or we need more working age people. So if you were to cut back on the young, you're cutting back on your real breadwinners, your real service providers, your taxpayers, your new home buyers. All the people who make the economy hum are those new workers. And that's the last group you want to cut back on.
Randall, in Japan, they had, what was it, the silver tsunami of the generation, that the aging generation. Is there the potential for that here?
I mean, that's certainly where the trends are headed nationwide, right? Total fertility rates are down and are starting to converge with rates, not say the ultra-low rates that you see in Japan or South Korea, but certainly to rates that are more similar to Northern Europe, and that some of the lowest rates of fertility are now among the most disadvantaged populations, and that's a relatively new thing. I think we want to be fairly careful about thinking about this in context, right? If you sort of look at the lists of the world's most desirable cities, Vienna, Sydney, cities in Japan, most of these are places that have, just to get back to that comment before, most of these are places that have moderate, low, slightly below replacement fertility. And so to some extent, I think we want to be careful on saying that there's, a right number of people for California, or, you know, the right amount of growth is the one that reflects everyone's needs being met is sort of my model for this. And so it's not, I think we should be fairly careful in sort of how we think about this.
Let's talk with Michael in Corona. Good to have you with us, Michael. Your thoughts on the slowing growth in California?
Hi. So I have two kids. I'm from San Francisco, and we left when our second one was born because it was just ridiculous to find some place to live. We moved to Fullerton, and again, it wasn't, you know, within the price range. And now we're in Corona. We have a space here, but we're looking to buy, and there's nowhere that we can even conceive of buying. And my wife and I are both entrepreneurs. And, you know, we both make good money, but we definitely can't afford housing here. So we're looking at Colorado, different places. But every time we move, it's like it's hard on the family, and it's, you know, get further and further away from the cousins and from my friends back in San Francisco. And it's just I'm living that scenario that you're speaking of.
Yeah. And Michael, what I appreciate about your call is you're describing sort of the wave of increasing cost of living as it swept you from northern to southern California, coastal to inland, and now looking at a state with an overall lower cost of living. Dal Myers, that in and of itself isn't necessarily a new trend. We all know people who moved to other states going back decades because it was less expensive to live there. But are the sheer numbers of people like Michael either considering or doing this higher?
We have a lot more people who are in the right age to move right now. The millennials are the prime moving ages, which is really the 20s and into the early 30s. And so they're very vulnerable to being pirated away by better opportunities. And once they go away, they can't afford to come back because they won't be on the housing escalator anymore here. They'll be on a lower escalator and they can't get back. So it's a permanent loss that we're suffering right now, it's not really sustainable. I just want to point out that the reason we have this top-heavy age structure isn't just because of fertility rates. It's who was born 60 years ago. It's the baby boomers, and I'm one too, so I can talk about my people. And I'll just say this: it wasn't our idea. It just happened. But we're living with the consequences of an extra large generation. We never had one that large. And we just, at this moment in time, we do not want to lose the underpinnings of our society and our economy, which is the younger workers.
Well, and the millennial generation, is it, it's almost as big as the boomers, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It depends on how you count it, but it's much bigger than the one right before it, which is Gen X.
Yeah.
Like 30% bigger. And so we felt a real jolt from the young people coming of age. And meanwhile, when they came of age, bad timing. It happened right in the Great Recession. And so we weren't building any housing at that moment. They needed apartments, and we didn't supply it. And we're still trying to catch – we're not catching up.
For millennial listeners, are they going to likely be facing this? Because now we're looking at decline in birth rates. So are millennials going to be in a few decades where boomers are now?
Well, I hope not. But it could be like an inverted pyramid. You mean like, so it's tiny at the bottom and fat on top? That's just not good. That's a very difficult model to sustain. Ideally, it would be even numbers in every age group, and that's the stationary population we aim for. But it is shrinking at the bottom.
All right. I want to thank you for discussing this and shedding some light on it. Obviously, it's going to be a challenge for the state to respond to the demographic shift. Dal Myers, USC demography professor. He directs the Population Dynamics Research Group at SC. And Randall Kuhn of UCLA, demographer and associate professor of community health sciences. It's Air Talk on 89.3. We'll be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We look forward to you joining us tomorrow as well. Film Week coming up at 11 o'clock. Our critics will be in to talk about the biggest movies of the week, including Long Shot, starring Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. Ugly Dolls, a new animated film as well. Right now, we turn our attention to tracking, that is, taking students according to their academic talents and putting them into tracks where the workload and the subject matter is going to be aligned with the ability of those students. Some think that tracking is harmful to the overall student population because it pulls the highest achievers out of the mainstream group. You don't have the modeling that comes with that. You may not have the strongest teachers who are working with the struggling students. And there's some who believe that the resources also shortchange those students that are struggling. But on the other side are those who say, if you don't accommodate the special needs of your highest achievers, they're going to go elsewhere outside of public education. They're going to find other ways, whether it's homeschooling or others, to not be bored in class and to find an academic experience that suits their abilities. I'd like to hear from you, if you're a parent of a child who's been tracked in school, what you think of the practice. Should students be mainstreamed, essentially not segregated according to academic ability? Or if you're someone who's a parent or a former student of someone who was tracked, I'd be interested in your thoughts on it. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. By way of full disclosure, when I was a student in the LA City Schools, I was tracked, and so it enabled me to be in an enriched environment with other students who shared my interests, and we were able to have the kind of classroom experience we likely wouldn't had we been in a mainstream student population. Joining me is Whitney Pirtle, assistant professor of sociology at UC Merced. She wrote a recent Atlantic piece titled "The Other Segregation," which was a critique of tracking. Professor Pirtle, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So we're looking at sort of, competing advantages or disadvantages. What are your biggest concerns about the practice of tracking students based on classroom performance?
I guess my biggest concerns about tracking students based on classroom performance is that the metrics we have for judging whether a student is academically gifted or on track or maybe falling behind don't always coincide with these objective measures of their academic ability. There's a lot of other factors that play into the relationships. Sometimes it's based on maybe implicit biases that teachers have, misunderstandings between what students have versus what their expectations are, bias in forms of standardized testing. And so as a sociologist who studies race and consistent with sociologists who also study education, what we find is that tracking ends up tracking out a lot of students of color into these classrooms. And so it's not just tracking, period. Oftentimes what we see is a racialized tracking where especially Black and Latinx students are not included in the ideas of gifted and talented students, not
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you in a sentence. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
So I wonder, is though the problem with tracking itself or that public schools don't do a good enough job of identifying students that might be quieter, that might come from disadvantaged backgrounds, that might be non-white, that's where the problem is? They're not being identified for the gifts they're bringing.
Yeah, that's such a big question. I think there's so many layers, but I do think one of the issues at the forefront is that there is not equal access into who is tracked into these gifted programs. And a lot of that does intersect across racial status, also class status and other forms of disability. In general, the ideals behind GATE are amazing, right? That students are being challenged in the classroom, they have small classrooms, and they're doing child-led initiatives. All of those things are wonderful. You know, as a sociologist, my goal would be to have every child have an opportunity like that within the public schools.
We're talking with Whitney Pirtle, assistant professor of sociology at UC Merced, author of the recent Atlantic piece, The Other Segregation. There are additional resources, professor, that go into children who have learning disabilities. Schools get additional, at least in California, additional money that the state of California identifies for schools in areas of lower income. So there are resources that are put in. Do you think it's wrong to put additional resources for the highest achieving students to try and help them not be bored and achieve the most they can?
Well, what we see is that the students who are often put into these classrooms that have extra resources to benefit their education also come from privileged families that also have a lot of resources that cultivate their student needs. And so what you see is kind of a hoarding of opportunities and a hoarding of privilege. And so I think that, you know, I think it's not necessarily a cut and dry issue, but I think when we look at the race and the class differences and the ways that especially privileged parents are able to navigate those things, we see kind of a hoarding, a piling on of privilege and resources in those classrooms. And that's really where I see the problem lying.
The other problem is, though, if you don't have that enriched for high-achieving students, they will go elsewhere. And then is it worse off to not have them in the public school district, to have them homeschooled, to have them in private schools, other environments, if they can't be part of an enriched environment? Because often for high-achieving kids, school is inherently boring anyway. I'd love to hear from listeners what you think about this. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, Professor of Clinical Education at USC, Chair of the Education Committee for the California Association for the Gifted, Sandra Kaplan. Professor, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So you've heard the points that have been made by Professor Pertl of UC Merced about how this can disadvantage students of need and those who don't have natural advantages that, you know, come out of the home or because of racism. How can you serve both masters here, so to speak, and have both groups of students get what's appropriate?
Well, what Professor Pertl is talking about is really the really current issue that we're all facing here in California and across the nation. And so one of the things that I think we need to look at is, first of all, there are a tremendous amount of people who are working very diligently to try to really change both the attitudinal reference and the practice implementation of what gifted education means and what it actually is, you know, intended to do. And so we're really looking at the fact that what she's saying is absolutely true. There is a disproportionate number of students in gifted programs who represent minority, whether it's cultural or academic or economic, et cetera. But what we're talking about currently is that this is a curricular issue. That gifted education is really defined by curriculum, how students are learned and what they are taught, and not a program issue such as tracking or separate classes. And so as we talk about the current kinds of things we want to do, we're talking about the following items. One is that all students should be given the opportunity to express their abilities. And my analogy is, you don't know that I can play tennis until you put me on the tennis court. We need curriculum that allows kids of all ages, of all groups, to show their ability. Curriculum that allows for the challenge of potential and the recognition of ability. We secondly need teachers who understand how to differentiate the curriculum, that it's not whether you're in a separate class or not, it's whether or not the curriculum is made amenable to your needs, your interest, and your abilities. And that one of the things that I think we're really facing is academic prejudice, the idea that people will say they're too young to do X or too young or not experienced enough to do Y, and therefore we withhold some of the opportunities of students from different backgrounds and don't give them that chance to show their potential. So we're really talking about teaching for potential and really looking at the opportunity that curriculum could provide. And just one other issue that I'd like to talk about in response to Dr. Priddle's comments in her article, and that is that until we help teachers understand that even if you put all the gifted students together, you still have a heterogeneous group, that you still need to look at individual differences, that all gifted students do not learn in the same way, at the same, you know, the same rate, then we're going to get stuck in not really seeing the individuality of giftedness rather than looking at it as just one global kind of definition.
We're talking with Sandra Kaplan, a professor at USC. We welcome your calls. Already a number of listeners wanting to take part in this conversation. We're talking about academic tracking of students in public school based on their academic expertise. Also talking about gifted and talented programs in public schools, where in some cases it's a gifted magnet that a student attends where all the students have been identified as gifted, the idea to provide them with an enriched and accelerated environment in which to learn, the idea being similar to a student who is in remedial classes, needs additional assistance to be able to perform at grade level, that they would be given a customized environment. But the question is, how do you do that in a way that realistically identifies the potential and current abilities of the mix of students in public schools? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're going to spend the rest of the program talking about this, so we'll have a chance to take numerous calls. Also coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross at the top of the hour, Terry's guest is Dexter Filkins, who's written a recent New Yorker piece on President Trump's National Security Advisor, John Bolton. Filkins says Bolton's interventionist worldview contrasts with the isolationist tendencies of President Trump and explores that in his new piece. That's Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up at noon right here on 89.3. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Tracking of students in public school, is it a net benefit or a net detriment to the overall student body? We're talking about the practice of taking students who are the highest academic achievers, putting them together into tracked programs. Sometimes that means that they're identified as gifted and talented in the highest level programs, so that they're not bored in school, have an enriched academic environment. But the question is, what is the effect of that on the other students in the school? We're talking with a writer of a recent Atlantic piece on this titled The Other Segregation, Whitney Pirtle, who's a professor at UC Merced. Sandra Kaplan, a USC professor who chairs California Association for the Gifted's Education Committee. She's also a GATE teacher for 3 years and coordinated for the Inglewood District's GATE program. I was an Inglewood student many, many years ago. And Lucy Hunt is LAUSD District Coordinator of Gifted and Talented Programs. Ms. Hunt, thank you very much for being with us. So what does LAUSD try to do to assure that you're identifying students regardless of where they come from, and fairly identifying them for a gifted and talented program or a higher level track?
Thank you so much for having me on, and I'm delighted to answer your question. So we are a little bit different than a lot of other school districts, which might use just one criteria in order to identify students as gifted. We actually have 7 different ways that we identify gifted learners. We identify them with intellectual assessments starting the second semester of kindergarten. We use grade and test scores where we identify students in the high achievement and specific academic categories. And then also, every single one of our second graders receives a screening assessment called the OLSAT 8, which can qualify them in the high achievement category. And if they come really close to passing that assessment, we ask schools to automatically refer them in the intellectual ability category. And then we actually identify in the visual and the performing arts. Students come in and they do auditions and demonstrations in voice, dance, drama, and fine arts. And then lastly, we identify in the creative and the leadership categories. So we cast an incredibly wide net, which is unusual. We also offer many, many different programming options for our gifted learners. And I think sometimes people are surprised to learn that the vast majority of our gifted remain in their regular home school of residence. And what our district policy is that we cluster our gifted. So on the elementary level, we recommend a minimum of 5 to 8 students in a classroom,
And on the secondary level, we recommend a minimum of 15 to 25 students. So a lot of our gifted learners are in a regular classroom. They're clustered with their academic peers, and they're with their grade level peers. So to build on to what Dr. Pirtle said, she was very concerned with equal access into programs, and I think we do a really good job with that. By the end of the year, we will have closely 70,000 identified gifted learners. Do we have work to do? Absolutely. Do we have disproportionality in our percentages? We do. 8% of our gifted is African American, and only 5% of those students are identified as gifted. And that's something we've been vigilantly working on for the last 10 years with the Office for Civil Rights. And we have so many different and innovative things that we do in order to close that achievement gap, in order to close that discrepancy. But what's kind of fascinating when you look when you look at our data at Magnets and Schools for Advanced Studies, 7 to 10% of our African-American students are represented in their programs. And of students taking AP classes, 19% are African-American.
So they're overrepresented in AP. That's interesting.
Correct. There are no barriers for students to take AP. Absolutely any student can take an AP class. And last year, there were 54,000 AP exams given.
We're talking with Lucy Hunt, who is a district coordinator at LA Unified of the Gifted and Talented GATE programs. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Gavin in Long Beach, your thoughts about tracking students according to classroom ability.
Hi, Larry. Love this conversation. Yeah, so when I was a student, which albeit was a while ago, GATE was pretty isolated from the rest of the student body. And I remember taking all varieties of classes, GATE, remedial, and regular. And even the same teacher, the content and the engagement was night and day. So what I'm happy to hear from the last speaker is that at least in LA, it seems like they're mixed in at an early age, because what concerns me about GATE is the very quick and high onset of stratification of the students. So by the time they get to high school, you have this huge population of students which is completely unprepared for AP, and that's what's so great about AP is that you can come in no matter your past.
All right, Gavin, I appreciate it very much. Kind of a unique experience taking GATE classes and remedial classes. Alexandra in Upland, your thoughts about tracking students.
Thank you. As a recent graduate with my bachelor's in college, I know that as a young professional, if it wasn't for my sixth grade teacher's tracking, I wouldn't be where I am today. To give an example, in sixth grade, I would be bored, humming in class, but I always did math problems a little different. And my professor told me I had alternate ways of thinking and creative, artistic abilities above my age. And if it wasn't for her individualized tracking, I wouldn't have transferred to a charter school and had been challenged there, which is still a public program, but it's lottery-based. And with this, I feel like tracking can't be generalized, because if it wasn't for that professor, I wouldn't have had the confidence and skills to move and to now working as an intern at a Fortune 500 company.
So you, but you ended up after you identified, as having a particular gift, then you were tracked in with fellow students of high level skills.
Correct, but it wasn't for that specific professor. This didn't go through a program. It was an individualized opportunity that a professor or teacher at that point gave to me and said, I don't think you should be in our school that doesn't have enough resources for you. I want to send you to, you know, a charter.
A place that would be a better fit. Alexander, I appreciate your call. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. If you're the parent of a student who is tracked currently, what do you think about that? What do you see as the pros and cons of tracking students based on ability? What do you see as the as the blind points where maybe the tracking is not picking up students who would be better served by being in an enriched environment, but for whatever reason are not identified as being suitable for going into that enriched environment. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Brittany in South Los Angeles said, took my mom 4.5 years to get my brother and I tested for giftedness. We're African American. If it weren't for the insistence of my mother, I would have been bored to tears in school. That's Brittany in South L.A. Talking about her mother's battle to make sure that she and her brother were tested. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Harriet in Long Beach, good to have you with us on AirTalk.
Hi, happy to be here.
So what are your thoughts about tracking?
When I was in high school back in the 60s, we all knew there were three sections. There was the first section. They were the smart kids. There was the second section. They were pretty smart, but not as smart as the first kid section. But then there was the third section, the average section, and that's the section I was in. And I always felt over the years that had impeded my own self-esteem. Because you are in this environment where you think, well, you're just not as good as everybody else, so why even try? And luckily, I had a talent that sort of overshadowed all that, but it still left an impression on me, and I think a lot of other kids as well.
What, just out of curiosity, what's that talent that enabled you to break out?
I sang. In fact, I would always had the leads and the musicals, and I was on stage with all those kids in the first section, and suddenly I felt equal to them because I could sing better than them.
Yeah. Well, and this may not be comparable, but there might be some students who would say, well, you know, in that case, you distinguished yourself with your voice. So you had the leads, you were in the, you know, the positions where you had an enriched environment, so to speak, because of your talent. There might be those who would argue, well, for kids who academically were, you know, sort of book achievers, that tracking them was their way. But is there a way, Harriet, that tracking could have been done without hurting your self-esteem? Or do you think it's inherent whenever you separate, it's going to make certain kids feel bad?
It's going to make you feel like you're just not as good as everyone else.
All right, Harriet, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll take more of your calls and speak more with our guests when we return in 1 minute. Listeners responding on the AirTalk page to our last caller and talking about being in the track with the average students in school and how that impeded her self-esteem. B.B. Steve writes on the page, the third section always had the most fun, though. H.M. writes, I'm sure being average impeded her self-esteem. Her being in my class would have been disastrous for the pace of learning for those who were more academically advanced. I was never offered a spot in the choir, however, maybe because I can't sing. That's H.M. writing on the AirTalk page. Jack in Zurich writes, look at what Germany does. In high school, they split kids into two tracks. One for kids who are going to go off to college, the other track providing essential training for skilled workers. So one part goes off to college. They become scientists, sociologists, professors, much like in the U.S. The other part goes off to become skilled workers in tech, doing automotive work for Porsche, BMW, etc. At the end of the day, both segments end up earning about the same. The skilled non-college people earn at a high level, and that's the difference between the U.S. and Germany. In the U.S., you have college kids earning a decent living, but if you didn't go to college, you end up essentially part of the unskilled labor force. That's Jack writing on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Now, Bob in Fullerton actually grew up under the German education system. So, Bob, hopefully you heard what Jack posted about Germany. What was your experience of it, Bob?
I did, and it was an interesting insight. It actually wasn't me. It was my children. I was an adult living in Germany with my two kids. And the German system, they in the fourth grade, teachers make a determination as to what track the kids are going to be on, and they go to different classes depending upon the track that they're put on, that sets them off to a college track or a trade school track. Right. One of the reasons why we wound up leaving Germany, because we were concerned that, you know, fourth grade was an awfully early to be making that sort of determination that's really life determinative. The upside to it is that there's a social expectation and not necessarily a stigma associated with the different tracks, right? As Jack pointed out in his comment, right, people grow up, go to trade schools, get great educations, get great jobs, and there you go.
And are respected.
It does result in a stratification of the society, you know, that really begins in the fourth grade.
All right. And so, Bob, you one of the reasons you left Germany was because of that?
Yeah, my kid was coming up to that fourth grade threshold. And, you know, there were other reasons as well, but he was coming up to that fourth grade threshold. And you know, I was a late bloomer. I did well in school, but I did well later in school. It took a while, right? And so, you know, kids develop at different paces, and it seemed awfully, given how consequential the decision was, it seemed awfully early to be making those kinds of calls.
All right.
They say once you're on one track, you know, you can, if you want to, move over to another track. But it's a cumulative thing, right? You go for 3 years in one track and then try and move over to a more advanced track. You're behind.
Yeah, that's going to be challenging. Bob, I appreciate it very much. Lisa in San Dimas, I understand you're a mom of three kids who were GATE students?
Yes.
So what was your thought on how it worked for them? And I understand you're also a speech-language pathologist, so you've seen the other side of this working with students with special needs. Do you see it as a net positive or negative?
You know, I think it needs to have a balance. I saw with my own children that it was hugely beneficial for them to be in the GATE program that we had in our school district because they were starting to get in trouble, goofing around because they weren't being challenged. And the teachers were working with them, knowing that, you know, they were needed to be challenged, and the teachers were doing that. But just when they got in on our program, and our district starts in third grade. My oldest son started, I think, when he was in second grade. But prior to that, I had been against the whole GATE thing, feeling like if there's special opportunities, everybody should have access to those opportunities for learning. But when I saw what it did for my kids, I kind of shifted my perspective. But when I say there needs to be balance, I totally get that there needs to be models for kids that aren't as advanced, and they need to have that exposure as well. But yet, when kids have special needs, they need to be those needs need to be focused on for part of their day.
Yeah. So it's a tough question. How much do you sacrifice the experiences of the more advanced kids in an effort to benefit the kids who are more challenged in school? Lisa, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Liz, in downtown Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk.
Hi. I was tracked when I was in school, and I tried the opposite of what the previous caller was talking about, two callers ago. I tried to get out of it at one point and went to a lower class.
Yeah.
I guess if you're talking about tracking.
Yeah.
And I was bored after about 3 minutes, and I went back and asked to be put back in my original class. I have a second grader now who has been, he bypassed the OLSAT test and had just a straight intellectual assessment test. And he has been tagged as highly gifted. And we're in a position now where I'm trying to figure out, do I take him out and put him in a gifted program, or do I keep him where he is because he's socially happy where he is?
Yeah.
So I don't know. And we're trying to gauge that because I don't want him to be bored.
Yeah. Lucy Hunt of LAUSD, coordinator for the Gifted Talented Programs. What advice would you give Liz about that?
Well, you know, the reason we have so many programming options for our gifted learners in this district is because depending on your child, you know, one of them is going to meet needs. Every one of our schools does have a gifted program and the clustering that I mentioned, but we do have magnet programs for our gifted and highly gifted students. And of course, it sounds like her child would be able to apply to either of those programs. And then lastly, we have 149 schools for advanced studies, which are resident schools that have been recognized as having exemplary gifted education going on there. So the nice thing is, when I get calls from parents, I really have a lot of options to go over with them, and that's exciting.
All right. I want to thank you. That's Lucy Hunt, LAUSD. Also, our thanks to USC professor Sandra Kaplan. She chairs California's Association for the Gifted Education Committee. And our thanks to Professor Whitney Pirtle. It's her piece in The Atlantic, The Other Segregation, that really kicked off our whole look at the tracking of students and whether it does more harm than good because of not identifying the many talents of students who may not get the same advantages for recognition in school. Professor Pirtle at UC Merced. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk. Then at 11 o'clock, it's Film Week with our critics. Have a great day.